Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Sara Gon. Sara, how are you doing?
Well, thank you. Thanks, Nick.
And, of course, we are joined today by special guest, Mr. David Ansara from the Center for Risk Analysis. You can find him on the Center for Risk Analysis YouTube channel and his own podcast, Solutions with David Ansara. And the Center for Risk Analysis has lots of good videos about risk policy analysis of the world, the country. I'm sure many of you have probably come across their videos if you're subscribed to us, but check them out if you haven't. Good stuff there. How are you, David?
I'm fantastic. Thanks, Nicholas. I'm feeling a little bit starstruck to be on the Daily Friend Show, I must confess.
I know. This is the sort of height of glamour when it comes to the entertainment and news world. But that aside, let us get... and I see we've got regular contributor, Mr. Terence Corrigan, in the audience today. So it's good, as always. Anyway, let us go boldly forth onto our topics for today. And this is a topic we considered talking about yesterday, but decided to bump. So we're going to bring it up today because it is quite an interesting story. But it's about these themes of South Africa's institutions and democratic structures creaking under the weight of misgovernance and malice. And this is, I think it was on Monday, Justice Bess Nkabinde, who is the judge responsible for granting requests for police agencies, security agencies, spy agencies to intercept people's communications. So if the police think that there's a terrorist plot or something, they can ask her for permission to spy on people, basically. She says that she is very concerned that people are not coming to seek permission from her when they're spying on people, particularly in the intelligence services. She said to Parliament, quote, "It is indeed a matter of great concern that there seems to be unceasing unlawful interception of communication of private and public officials. These matters are, in light of the constitutional imperatives and the rule of law, most disturbing and cannot be left unchecked by the relevant ministry or department of the agency implicated." Well, I've long joked that South Africa certainly has spies, but I'm not sure if they spy on anyone except us. Sara, what do you make of this?
There's something rather charming about her outrage at the at what she's discovering, and not to say that it isn't warranted outrage. It's that, given the state of our security services, whether they be the police or intelligence or whatever it may be, it is not surprising that some of the permissions granted by her to intercept communications would be used for reasons other than, or in ways other than she's actually granted them. And that appears to be the main thing. I think one of the examples was given was sort of permission to intercept communications of journalists based on the fact that they are suspected of being involved in ATM bombings. I mean, I think these guys have probably been doing it for so long that it's that kind of go and get the permission, say it's for this, we'll go and do that. And it's only when it actually is brought to her attention, and all credit to her for it, that she said, you know, this is excessive. It's a complete abuse of process, and it's a complete abuse of the authority she gives to them to do such interceptions. And of course, from a privacy point of view, it's absolutely outrageous. But I'm not sure any of us would be surprised, because if you think about it, particularly, let's take our police services as an example. You know, they have such a bad reputation at this point that one probably wouldn't be far wrong in assuming that in absence of such authorization to intercept, they probably wouldn't do much of a job of actually trying to resolve anything and to find evidence to support them.
One of the most disturbing things that's come out recently about state security services spying on people is that News 24 editor-in-chief Adrian Basson claims that he has been a target of spying from SAPS, And that his communication was intercepted, and this appears to be unlawful because it's not clear that any, if that's true, it's not clear that any permission was granted by a legal structure. There's one other thing, of course, in this article that I'm referencing, which is that South Africa has something called the Office of Interception Center, which is supposed to coordinate all of the spying, basically, for law enforcement in South Africa. And in a report submitted to Justice Mkabinde, it was revealed by the head of South Africa Security Services that the systems that this interception unit uses are outdated, regularly collapsed, and they were unable to spy on anything apart from voice and SMS data, not being able to track WhatsApp voice calls, Skype emails, Facebook, or other social media platforms. David, you made a comment just before the show that I thought was pretty good to describe this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Nick, I was just saying that this is a classic South African case of a mixture of incompetence and malice. Usually, Hanlon's razor you can ascribe to incompetence rather than malice, people's intentions. But I think this is a case of both. And I think it kind of goes to the heart of our administrative capacity of the state, and also the way in which it's been riven by factionalism. I think if you look at, for example, the Edward Snowden affair, the NSA, the agency that he was working for, was operating at an extremely high level of sophistication, was able to essentially monitor communications on any device in any part of the world. And I doubt very much whether South Africa's security personnel have the capacity to do that. But I still think it's concerning to hear these allegations, and say what you will about Mr. Basson's politics. I think it is concerning that, high-profile journalists are being tapped in this way. And, I think it is something that we should be alive to, because you really don't want to cede that kind of level of power to the state.
Right. And I think there was a fair amount of paranoia in the wake of the July riots in the Ramaphosa camp. About perhaps the fact that the security agencies had not been, there was at least a sort of suspicion kind of said between the lines that the security agency was perhaps far more aligned to Jacob Zuma and therefore had not warned them of the upcoming riots. I don't know what you make of that theory, if you think that there's anything perhaps to that.
Well, I mean, I think the riots really underscored just how woeful our security services are. And I think that a lot of the PR that was coming out in the wake of the riots is that this is this sophisticated conspiracy. If it was indeed a conspiracy, which we doubt that it was, then why didn't the security personnel pick that up? Either they just are incapable of doing their jobs, or maybe the underlying assumptions of the narrative are flawed.
I just think that, the minister, his name suddenly escapes me, who was the intelligence minister, said that they had garnered intelligence and they had fed it to the police, and the police had done nothing. And of course, her report is under wraps, so no one in the public domain can see that report. So we don't know whether, in fact, it was their fault or the police's fault or both their fault or one or other. And perhaps, I don't know. We know how critical what a mess it is and how much of state security is used for intra-factional fights within the ANC. We're talking hundreds of applications for the right to intercept. So presumably it's not all, ANC versus ANC, Zuma faction versus Ramaphosa faction. But we don't know, and that's the problem. We can only, I think our natural inclination is to assume the worst.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. All right, let us move then on to our next topic, and that is, of course, our friend, or not really our friend, Western Cape Judge President John Hlophe, who is currently facing impeachment. This is a rare process in South Africa. I think he's the first senior judge or something to be facing impeachment. Yeah, and he is going before, he will presumably be going before Parliament soon, and they will vote on whether to remove him from his office as a judge. However, he is not going to go down without a fight, and perhaps taking some inspiration from his friend Jacob Zuma, he has decided to go to court to prevent his impeachment. Sarah, what's the latest on this?
Just to give you a bit of sort of technical background, essentially, if a complaint is lodged to the Judicial Service Commission, which is the right party, the commission then, or the committee then looks at the issue and refers it to a committee that deals with the actual misconduct, a conduct committee. They then investigate the matter and they then send a recommendation, a report to a tribunal, a Judicial Service Commission tribunal, who will go through the report and they will decide whether to refer the matter to the National Assembly. Now, ultimately the impeachment is signed off by the President, but it can only be signed off after 2/3 of the National Assembly has supported it. So it's quite a long process, and it's a process that has been susceptible to 13 years worth of Stalingrad strategy of applications on technical issues on left, right, and center. And the point he's making two points to his application to the Joburg High Court to set this process back or set the decision aside. The first is that when the Judicial Service Commission considered whether to refer the matter, it wasn't properly quorate. It didn't have the judge president there. It didn't have the deputy judge president. So in other words, the figures from the JSE who are meant to be there to make that decision were not there. So technically, the decision is null and void. The other thing he wants to do, and this probably has more legs to it, is that he wants a whole lot of people who are on the commission to recuse themselves because they are biased against him for one or other reasons. And so given the fact that these decisions are made by judges, it's the judge president of Gauteng, it's a judge in another thing, and it's literally about four or five people who are deemed unsuitable to his matter because they are they're prejudiced. Now, whether if this were accepted and they did recuse themselves, whether there would be enough judges left to actually fill the void, I don't know, but that's the sort of, let's put it this way. What we do with judges is every time a delay happens, it kicks the judge closer and closer to retirement age and closer to a pension.
So my question, I guess, on that point specifically is, I mean, does that mean that, how likely is he to be able to get those recusals? Because if you decide to go and make an enemy of every single judge in the country, and then say, no one can try me.
it's virgin territory, this, but I think the part of what they would probably consider is the fact that judges are supposed to have the capacity to see beyond their personal animuses, if there's such a word. And, you know, certainly want to know about the judiciary. You know, it's like a corporate environment. There are plenty of people who dislike each other intensely. Whether it would be considered a valid issue, to be honest, I'm not sure.
David, what do you make of this whole mess? Do you think that George Lopez is going to be able to drag this proceeding out as he has for many years?
Yeah, I think something that really strikes me about this is just how long this matter has been going on for. I mean, I remember when I was a student at UCT, which was quite a long time ago, John Chope was making the news for all the wrong reasons, and particularly around the Zuma matter and these allegations that he inappropriately approached justices of the Constitutional Court. I think it was Sisi Kampepe and Judge Jafta as well. And, you know, I think it's pretty remarkable how individuals like him, like Mr. Zuma, are able to use democratic processes and the rule of law to defend themselves against allegations of malfeasance. I mean, I guess it's one of those aspects of democracy that you kind of have to live with, that proceduralism is important. You need to do the right legal processes, and, you know, the wheels of justice do grind slowly. But there is a point where you have to say, okay, well, justice delayed is justice denied, and when is this matter going to be resolved? And, I mean, surely I'm not privy to all of the exact rules, but, you know, if somebody is an acting Chief Justice or an acting Deputy Chief Justice, surely they now occupy that office and can sit in that capacity. So, you know, I think he's obviously, you know, throwing up smoke and trying to remove people who may be perceived to be against him. I think Alan Windey, he's also challenging his place on the JSC. But I also think also raises a lot of questions around the actual power and capability of the JSC. It doesn't, I think it's a good idea to have such a body, but I think it's too stocked with politicians and not enough members of the legal profession and academia and the bench.
Go on, Sarah.
No, I was just going to say, it partly goes back to your point about Judge Shlopin not being, you know, sort of much liked, and therefore recusal is an option. One has to bear in mind that this particular matter, as they've discussed, is about his interference with judges over trial matters affecting Zuma and trying to encourage them to look in favor of Zuma. The things that have happened more recently, such as allegations of assault, threatening, some really appalling behavior towards other judges and towards members of the legal fraternity. It's a bit like Zuma. You know, we're dealing at the moment only, we are still only dealing with the corruption charges related to the arms deal. So the charges that he's dealing, that he's facing, only deal with the trying to suborn the two justices. The later stuff hasn't even come forward yet. But, you know, on the assumption that you can delay this, you know, those things still have to go through the process. But what it does is highlights an inequity of, or contradiction to the idea that of everyone being equal before the law. And that's a fundamental aspect of the rule of law. The problem is equality before the law depends on resources. And most of us could not begin to afford a process that lasts for 13 years. But who are the people who can? The people who have access to state funds to fund their legal processes. So that would make judges, politicians, former presidents, et cetera, et cetera. And that is probably one of the most pernicious aspects, because if I were fired and I wanted to challenge my dismissal, there's probably only a certain extent to which I could go before the financial pressure got too much and the process would have to end. And I think that would apply to most of us. But in his case, as in Zuma's case, things rumble on.
I think what's you guys mentioned Windy earlier, and I think what's quite amusing in this story is, so one of the ways that he became notorious, I think, was his constant feuding with the DA. The DA has long believed him to be completely biased against him, against them rather. And Chlope said of Windy, Alan Windy, the Premier of the Western Cape, that Windy had adopted inexplicable animosity towards him, and that therefore he had to be recused, and that the only basis that Windy had done this on was that he was a, quote, staunch and committed member of the DA. If somehow Chlope comes through all of this, I'm not really sure how he's going to be able to not be recused from any case involving the DA in the future.
But it does highlight the real problem when any member of the judiciary is less than, morally fit, shall we say.
David, any final thoughts on this topic before we move on?
Yeah, I just think one of the sad consequences of this is that it's, in terms of what I'm hearing from advocates at the Cape Bar, for example, is that morale is at an all-time low, and that judges are feeling like it's just a completely toxic environment, and that's been caused by Mr. Schlope. And, you know, the intimidation of other judges, often spurious allegations of racism are leveled against white judges in order to deflect criticism against Schlope. And I was just perusing through Slope's Wikipedia page. And I mean, there are allegations going all the way back to 2004. And, you know, he was appointed as a high court judge when he was 36 years old in 1996, and then was appointed to be the Cape judge president in the year 2000. You know, so I think this is also the manifestation of, you know, the kind of transformania that's gripped all institutions in our society, and the judiciary is no exception. That you just have to have judges with the right color, no matter what their credentials or their character. That's the most important thing. And, you know, I think the fallout and the damage to the legal profession in the Cape has been extreme. And I think this should be a cautionary tale for us when we look at the criteria for appointing judges. And the JSC itself has imposed a racial criteria in its selection of constitutional court justices. And, you know, we saw, for example, Judge David Unterhalter, who couldn't be more qualified for the position of constitutional court judge. He's a high court judge. He was an excellent silk, and he was kind of bypassed because he didn't demonstrate sufficient a commitment to the transformation agenda. And I think he might get another bite at the cherry. But, you know, I think the consequence is that we are excluding top legal talent from the judiciary at a time, critical time in our country and for the rule of law. So if you consider some of the high profile cases that have been before the court recently, the Zuma matter being one, the IEC matter being another, you really want the kind of top legal minds to be on the bench. You know, also if you're not fit in terms of your character, I think that that's a serious problem, for society more broadly. And I think, you know, something also that struck me about the previous story as well. So we have a lot of rules in our country, FICA, RICA, any number of anti-corruption laws, but you fundamentally need a culture of accountability for a democracy to work. And I don't think in many other mature democracies, somebody like Slope would be able to get away with what he's gotten away with, you know, given the position that he occupies. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Just a word on Slope. I mean, by all accounts, he was in very, but you know, it's always a risk when somebody's young and they haven't had a practical experience in the legal world, that, you know, it's not an ideal position to put someone in those circumstances, and it probably will likely lead to an overweening sense of omnipotence.
Indeed. Anyway, let's call that to a close now and move overseas for our discussion of the US. Now, we haven't talked that much about the US recently. We covered an enormous amount towards the end of last year because, of course, the American election was going on. So we've kind of stayed away from it for a bit. But there is some news from the US, which is perhaps worth talking about, and that is the recall effort in the US state of California. Of course, California is America's biggest state with its largest economy and largest population. And the governor, who is a Democrat, called Gavin Newsom, was facing a recall due to unhappiness with him for a variety of reasons. His reputation has been damaged because he's allegedly the kind of politician who goes around and tells every constituency precisely what they want to hear, regardless of whether it conflicts with something else he said in the past. He also had a bit of a reputation for, shall we say, being flexible with his own COVID rules. At a time when indoor dining was banned in California, Newsom was caught on video meeting with the senior officials of the state's health apparatus in conditions that would violate his own lockdown rules. But on top of that, there's been other problems with California that we will go into. And so there's a system in California where you are able to recall your governor if you get a petition with enough signatures on it. And this succeeded. And so there was an election to decide whether he was in fact going to be recalled. And Newsom has managed to triumph. We don't have the final results yet because California elections are a messy affair. I think they've been voting for something like 3 weeks. They don't all vote on one day. And they also take a very long time to count the votes. I don't quite know how this happens because South Africa, we count the votes faster with much less, but whatever. And out of a huge mass of, there were also a huge mass of people running to replace him as governor. So the ballot had essentially two questions. The first one is, do you want to remove Newsom as governor? And the second question was, if you remove him, who will replace him? And it seems like the leading candidate to replace him there was Republican Larry Elder, who is a talk show, sort of conservative talk show host, who managed to get 45% of those votes. However, it was moot in the end because Gavin Newsom triumphed with at least sort of around 55 to 66% of voters saying that he should remain in office. David, what do you make of this? What does it say about California and about the US and about us, perhaps?
Well, when I was reading some of the stories, I thought this feels eerily familiar to us here in South Africa, where you have a political constituency that regularly goes out in support of the incumbent party, and no matter what kind of odious individual is put forward, they always tend to support him. So I think California has been blue for as long as I remember, although wasn't Ronald Reagan governor of California at one stage? So they have
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, and he actually, Schwarzenegger succeeded in ousting
the last recall. Yeah.
Yeah, I think his name was Davis. And and then went on to enjoy quite a lot of popularity. Although I remember some of the fiscal problems that California has today started in the Schwarzenegger era, and he was accused of spending well beyond the government's means. And actually, if you kind of dig into some of the books on California, you'll see they're really struggling with fiscal problems. So quite similar to South Africa, energy security. They've tilted heavily towards windmills, but more like solar panels. And I think there's a kind of political culture that favors a kind of green energy, and a lot of kind of coastal liberals very concerned about the environment. But the consequences are that they often have rolling blackouts in California. They're closing down, under Newsom, closing down one of their nuclear facilities. So the environmental activist, Michael Schellenberger, has been very critical of that. He's been saying, well, look, Newsom is doing what's kind of politically popular, but ultimately lack of energy supply is going to undermine California's dynamism as an economy. But look, I think a lot of the Silicon Valley companies are still there. California itself is a huge economy because of Silicon Valley. But you are starting to see some worrying signs as well. So, for example, homelessness in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. I think in San Francisco it's gone up by about 30%. Whereas in other places like New York, they've had actual declines in homelessness. And New York shelters about 95% of its homeless. I think the more favorable weather conditions in California mean that people can kind of live rough on the streets in a tent and, not suffer the kind of same severe cold that you would get, for example, in New York. So what's happened is there's been this proliferation of these kind of tents all over places. People openly using drugs. There's a huge surge in fentanyl abuse and deaths as well. I think all societies have problems. But if you look across the United States, I think California's performance has actually been pretty dismal. It seems like the state is going backwards. And one consequence also is that many people are now packing their bags and leaving, citing tax reasons, amongst other things, and going to states like Florida and California. Florida and Texas. And, and taking their blue votes with them to those states as well. So Texas actually, I think it was the last congressional election, the one before that, where Ted Cruz narrowly held on to his Senate seat. I think Texas is looking like it might become a bit of a purple state. So I find it ironic that people vote for kind of leftist policies in California, and when the full effects of those are brought to bear, they think, no, this is all quite uncomfortable. I'm going to go somewhere else and continue to vote blue. I mean, maybe making it overly partisan, but I was kind of struck by the irony of that.
Sarah, in 30 seconds or so, your thoughts.
I think Gavin Newsom was, before he was governor of California, he was the mayor of San Francisco, by all accounts. I mean, San Francisco has really, as a sort of livable city, has degenerated. The mistake he's made, I think, for many people who would have voted against him, was following the BLM line and defunding the police, cutting police budget. And that's had an effect both on, obviously, the morale of the police and their ability to fight crime. And if that sort of grows and gets out of hand, he may not be secure for all that long.
And they've also decriminalized the theft of items under $900. So you have these scenes of people just walking into a Walmart or a Walgreens or something, just picking up stuff and walking out, and nobody calls the police because they don't bother. So, yeah, that's what happens when you kind of undermine the kind of the basic social fabric with a well-meaning but disastrous rules.
The opposite of a broken window syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. I suspect that he only managed to survive in this this recall because the Democratic Party apparatus swung very strongly behind him and managed to demonize the entire recall effort as a sort of Republican effort, although I don't think that's entirely a fair characterization. And sort of as California has twice as many Democrats as Republicans, that inevitably resulted in their defeat. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today because we are over time. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please support the Institute of Race Relations, which of course powers the Daily Friend. And you can do that by going to our website, ir.org.za, and clicking the Join Us button. Anyway, thank you very much, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.